This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about one of the most thankless yet necessary jobs in human civilization. No one wants to see the coroner at the door.
It is literally the hardest part of our job to go and make a death notification to a family.
Peoria County Coroner Jamie Harwood and other coroners in the region talk with Eric Stock about the human part of their public office. Plus, Ryan Denham reports on the next piece of tech infrastructure needed for widespread adoption of electric vehicles, charging stations. It's only the second day of class at ISU, and already three students have been disowned by their families for coming out as LGBTQ. And Mary Cullen talks with a White House drug policy official who visited Bloomington Normal. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Author Terry Pratchett once wrote, "No one is actually dead until the ripples they cause in the world die away." This story is about the first of those ripples, when people find out about the death of a loved one. The coroner is the last person you want to see knocking at your door. Coroners say telling people someone close has died is easily the hardest part of the job, yet it's often overlooked. There's no standardized training. WGLT's Eric Stock reports on how coroners in Central Illinois do this part of their work.
Death does not at first make sense to the minds of those left behind. Time and self-understanding alleviate suffering, but the pain of human loss is universal. Coroners see that truth every day at the first raw moments of the people they have to tell that their someone has died. Peoria County Coroner Jamie Harwood says he was dreading a visit he was about to have with a mother he knew. A year earlier, Harwood had informed the woman her son had died in a car accident. Early one morning late last year, he was back at her door after another son died.
It was just a heavier doom that I felt that I had to do the same thing again to the same family. And it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. They knew when they saw me knocking on the door, they knew why I was there at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Harwood had a career in nursing before becoming Peoria County Coroner in 2016. He also has a background in critical care. Even for someone who handles death for a living, Harwood calls that one of the worst days of his career.
It was worse because I was there again, and then they knew why I was there, and so I think they just carried the first tragedy into the second one.
Death notifications are a part of the job for coroners. Tim Rustman has been coroner in Woodford County for 25 years and counting. When he gets word of a death and he must tell the family, Rustman goes through a mental checklist before heading out.
Every time when I'm on my way, I start thinking, okay, how am I going to open this conversation? What am I going to say? What are the facts? Is this a case that potentially we need to approach this family about maybe being an organ or tissue donor? Those are things that always have to, you want to know. So I kind of rehearse it in my mind, if you will, before I get there.
Rustman says you never know how the family member will react to being told their loved one is gone.
It doesn't always go that way, of course, but there's certain key elements of notifying of the death that you do want to hit on.
Most coroners go in twos. They bring along a deputy or someone from law enforcement or clergy for backup and additional support for the family and the coroner. Jamie Harwood reminds himself to always speak with the victim's family at eye level. He says you can't soften the message with euphemisms.
You have to say words like, John Smith has died. Your daughter, Joan Jones, has passed away or has died. You have to use words that really bring truth to the matter as opposed to some facade that they could, lead to believe something different than other than what has truly happened.
And you can be direct while also showing empathy to help someone realize they are not alone. That's according to Livingston County Coroner Danny Watson.
To every person, the death thing is a very personal thing, and they think that nobody really knows how they feel. And that's probably true. but I can still empathize in what they're going through because I've been through it multiple times.
Watson says he was orphaned at age 13, and except for his sister, his family is gone. Ultimately, coroners say it's critical to show compassion in whatever way possible.
I do hug. I'm a hugger.
Kathy Yoder has been the McLean County coroner since 2014, after a two-decade career in nursing. Yoder says her knack for caring for others goes all the way back to grade school as a hospital volunteer at what is now Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal.
I remember doing that when it was Broca, and I was a little candy striper, and I think it was seventh grade as a little volunteer, and I'd pass waters around, and I thought that was great, and all my little Halloween costumes as a little girl was a nurse, and I took care of my dollies, and that's what I did, and I couldn't think of any other way, and I wanted to take care of others.
Now that means taking care of people after someone they love is gone. Yoder says her office is the voice for those who no longer have one by helping families process everything that must be done after a loved one's death, including organ donation, the autopsy, and funeral arrangements. Most death notifications happen in person. Yoder says in rare cases, she is said to notify family by phone if they don't have close relatives nearby or her office does not know where they live. She says those cases are often tragic in their own way.
The ones over the phone have a tendency to may have known that it was coming. Or if it's an older person, sometimes they haven't had contact with the decedent in years.
Yoder also has some help few coroners have when comforting grieving families. He's not a deputy coroner, but this chaplain has witnessed his share of tragedy.
I guess I approached Kathy and I interviewed for a job position that didn't even exist.
That's Stuart Blade. He was a veteran Bloomington firefighter. He says he felt called to help other families grieve.
If we can provide one area that just provides a little comfort in a process of what's going on for that family, that's an amazing thing that we get to do.
Blade knows something of heartbreak. 6 years ago, he and his wife lost their daughter, Hope, to a birth defect 7 hours after she was born. They have four other children. About 4.5 years ago, Blade talked with Yoder about becoming a coroner's office chaplain. Yoder gave it some thought, and then weeks later came one of the biggest tragedies in Bloomington Normal history. A plane crash in April of 2015 near Bloomington killed seven well-known men on their way back from an NCAA basketball championship game. They're referred to as the Redbird Seven for their ties to Illinois State University. Blade was working with the Bloomington Fire Department unit that arrived on scene that morning looking for the plane through the heavy fog.
Just the amount of notifications that they had to make that morning, going from home to home and visiting seven homes. Kathy called me that day, and it was April 7th that day that it was just like, hey, this is happening. Like, we're moving forward, and that was the day that I was brought onto the team.
Yoder says even though she had trained for mass casualty event, nothing prepares you for the physical, mental, and emotional burden of the real thing and helping the families of the survivors cope.
That went on for a long time, and then it's all about them. It's not about me, but I do know that those were long days and trying to give 100% to the families, if not more, and that took an emotional toll on everybody involved that I'll never forget it.
A month after that incident, Blade became an ordained minister. Earlier this year, he took his calling a step further and left the fire department to join Eastview Christian Church in Normal, where he is the associate pastor of small groups. In his role as coroner's chaplain, Blade says it's less about talking than it is about listening.
I'm not a therapist, but you are trained in the art of just being quiet, and I think that there's a lot of value in that.
Blade says he likes to get people talking about favorite memories of their just departed loved one.
I think that's one of my favorite moments of doing this, where you get to, not to just see there, but just see that they're like, what a great lifetime we had together, or these are the great moments, and don't forget those moments.
Blade says he's careful not to lead with his faith, partly because you don't know what religion a person does or doesn't have.
I still don't hesitate to ask the question, can I pray for you? But then I enjoy reading, and some of the books that I've read are just different cultural, finding out, okay, what does it look like when somebody of a different faith, what is the process that they take when somebody of that faith passes away?
Blade says another reason to steer clear of mingling church and state is that he is a county employee. Woodford County Coroner Tim Rustman says technology has made death notification more difficult in recent years. Sometimes the family finds out in other ways, maybe through a social media post or an online photo of a crash scene. Rustman says that puts additional pressure on coroner's staff to get to the family first.
It feels like you're almost under the gun now, where you have to, you know, once there's a motor vehicle accident, let's say, you need to really, you know, make sure that you get to that home and get that family notified, because people may drive by with a cell phone and inadvertently take a picture, do something, and next thing you know, a family member is seen on Facebook.
A change in state law several years ago allows coroners to determine a cause of death on their own without having to convene a citizen jury. Rustman says inquests often forced grieving families to relive a tragedy and delayed death benefits and closure.
Some of these counties were being inundated with motor vehicle accidents, let's say, and it would take 2 to 3 months before they could get their inquest set, get their jurors called in. And that whole time, the family did not have copies of that death certificate. And that puts a young mother that lost her husband and has 3 children, she needs those death certificates immediately to get on with her business.
Coroners try to become one with the grieving family, although that takes an emotional toll over time. McLean County handled more than 1,300 deaths last year, nearly 4 per day. Kathy Yoder says about 1 in 5 deaths required an investigation. Coroners also need someone to help them cope.
I have a great husband. How about that?
Yoder is married to Bill Yoder, a circuit judge in McLean County.
Well, the one good thing is he understands my job and he understands what I do. So the dialogue is wonderful there. He's very supportive, and I'm also supportive of his career. So I think that is actually a great working relationship.
Tim Rustman in Woodford County says he too looks to family for comfort when he can.
I give my kids extra hugs sometimes. I remember shortly after my wife died of a brain tumor, my very first coroner's call was a young man that died of a brain tumor, and I thought, you know, how lucky is that?
Rustman says separating public life from private is difficult when his small town community has known him as the bearer of bad news for so long.
Probably the most difficult thing for me is I've done this for so long. If I will call someone on the telephone, or when my dad was running for a political office, I would knock on a person's door and say, hi, I'm Tim Rustman, and this look on their face would just be like, oh no, what's he going to tell us? So, you know, it's not always, I don't always bring bad news.
There is an upside as well to being a small community coroner. Livingston County's Danny Watson lives in Flanagan, population 1,000. Watson says not being a stranger has helped.
Since most people know me somewhat, that it makes things a little easier. Rather than a total stranger, they know who's coming to the door, and they know why.
Peoria County Coroner Jamie Harwood says he learned long ago you can't dwell on the job.
In the moment, emotionally, physically, and compassionately, but when I leave that moment, I leave the moment. I don't carry that moment with me through the rest of my day. My training in nursing has really taught me that there's another family waiting, maybe in another room, maybe in another, you know, another place that they're going to need you.
Harwood says it's important to convey compassion not only to grieving families, but sometimes to the community as a whole. Peoria County has had several notable deaths in recent months, including the state's attorney and the county clerk. The style of public death announcements differs from coroner to coroner. Some simply try to dryly report facts. Harwood tends to show artistic flair. He sometimes posts phrases on social media like, "It is with a heavy heart that we report someone's passing, and I'm deeply saddened to announce someone's passing." Harwood says it seems like the right thing to do when a community is in mourning.
I'd like to think that the public deserves the information that I give them. And sometimes I have to refrain from writing their obituary, you know what I mean? But I want people to know that they're important and that they have families.
Harwood says that's a style he developed on his own.
The funny thing is when you become coroner, they don't give you a media relations class. You don't get templates on how to send out releases or anything like that. So a lot of it has been a growth experience for me.
In fact, there is no real death notification training for coroners at all. Many have on-the-job experience from previous careers in medicine or funeral homes, but elected coroners in Illinois and most states don't have to have training or certification. Woodford County Coroner Tim Russman is a funeral director. He says the soft skills are something a coroner simply has to have.
There is a system there, that, you know, the electoral system. If you have a coroner that obviously can't perform the duties, they're not going to be around very long. So, you know, it's the technical side of things can be taught. You can go to classes, you can go to seminars, you can learn that. The empathy and the compassion part, I think, is God-given. You just are either born with it or you're not.
Russman says it can be hard to process the never-ending cycle of grief coroners face, though he takes comfort in making sure grieving families know where they can turn for help.
I see a lot of these departments do debriefings, de-stressings, things like that. You hear a lot about PTSD. I don't know, I have learned over the years to put a positive spin on it as I am really helping these people at the worst time of their life.
Most coroners, including McLean County's Kathy Yoder, says the job reinforces the truth that time is precious.
You never know when your last day is your last day, so enjoy your life, enjoy your family, love your friends, because you never know, but you can't worry about that.
Empathy also does not stop with the fact of the death. Coroners are resource centers for grief pamphlets, places of worship, and just being available to them 24/7. Coroners say help for grieving families can go on for weeks or months after a death. I'm Eric Stock.
Cook County is the only county in Illinois that doesn't have a coroner. It has a medical examiner, which the county appoints.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State's 69.1% graduation rate is well above the national average. Illinois State's retention rate also remains among the highest in the nation at 78.6%. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the next step in electric vehicle adoption involves charging infrastructure. Ryan Denham will have more. Last month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported a 5% decrease in opioid-related deaths nationwide in 2018. It's the first decrease in nearly 30 years. A senior official with the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy visited Bloomington's Chestnut Health Systems to gain insight on how addiction treatment is covering rural residents. WGLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Ann Hazlett about how Chestnut is measuring up nationwide.
I think one of the most encouraging things that I heard about was a lot of partnership and the opportunity to bring people working together. The facility here at Chestnut working closely, for example, with the hospital and with the school systems, and seeing how we can reach people in different settings.
Chestnut Health System says they most commonly see residents with alcohol addiction. About 60 or over 60% of the people that come through their doors have an addiction to alcohol. How does that compare to the national level?
In many of the communities, particularly in rural areas that I travel and our leaders travel, yes, alcohol is an ongoing challenge that we need to continue to address in the face of these other threats like opioids and methamphetamine.
Commonly seen here at Chestnut are long wait times to get into a residential treatment for women and for men up to 3 months. There's also an issue with how long residents can stay within the treatment program here. Can you give voice to that and talk a little bit about the long-term implications of that?
The wait times are something that we are working incredibly hard at the federal level to ensure that no matter where someone is living, that when they are ready to get help, that treatment is available. This is something that's a partnership between the Congress and the administration. Having the funding to build this infrastructure is important, but then also at that community level, you know, we can have places that people can go for treatment, but also taking the stigma off of getting treatment. If it's available, going ahead and ensuring that people go and get it. In terms of the amount of time that somebody is able to stay in a facility, I think this only underscores the the need as well to ensure that we have those recovery services that are in communities, both in a Chicago as well as in a rural area that we see in the southern part of the state, or even here in Bloomington, that people will have the need, the services they need to stay healthy long term.
Now, in your meeting with Chestnut representatives here in Bloomington, you brought up the fact that rural communities have a stronger issue when it comes to getting their residents in contact with addiction services. Two of the things that were brought up in this meeting was the fact that in rural communities there's higher stigma rates and issues with transportation in regards to getting to a treatment facility. Can you talk about how we address those concerns and what are the steps moving forward?
Stigma remains a challenge across our country, but particularly in rural areas. And sadly, the breadth and the scope of the opioid crisis in particular, I think, has begun to change that conversation in a lot of communities. Often the most powerful antidote for stigma is a person being sharing their story when they're impacted, whether it's losing a brother or a father or, you know, a beloved student, peer in a school. So sharing stories and creating safe places that people can talk openly about what's happening in their community is an important first step.
Opioid-related deaths, they might be plateauing, maybe decreasing a little bit, according to the most recent reports from the CDC. Can you talk about, from your perspective, what the status of the opioid epidemic is currently and how treatment is going across the nation?
We are seeing signs of progress. There was some numbers that were released last month that suggested that the provisional numbers, deaths are down almost 5% for 2018. This would be the first decline that we've seen in over 30 years. But at our team, under the leadership of Jim Carroll, who is our drug czar, we will continue to fight because every life is precious and every day matters in our work.
And how about steps in the process of preventing opioid addiction from the front side?
There's also been a lot of work done here as well. There's federal dollars through our drug-free communities program at the national level, and then here in the community, seeing partnerships like the recovery-oriented systems of care, the ROSC system that I heard about in Illinois this morning. Those types of coalitions where we can bring many different community interests together are critical to preventing that next generation from beginning drug use in the first place.
Illinois recently legalized recreational marijuana, becoming in effect January 1st of next year. What do you think about recreational use? And what do you think about possibility for nationwide legalization?
These are decisions that are being made at a state level, and we think it is important to have adequate research so that when policymakers are making these choices, that they're fully informed.
WGLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Ann Hazlett, a White House senior advisor. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
For many of us, the sound of summer is an elusive ice cream truck with a herd of kids giving chase. If that's the sound of summer, Morning Edition is the sound of the start of your day. From shocking swimming pool news,
1 in 4 people admitted to peeing in a pool as an adult,
to debates on dessert.
Cup or cone?
Cone.
Sugar or waffle?
Listen every day from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Normandy Village, hosting Bocce at the Village, where two-person teams compete in a double elimination tournament September 7th. Family-friendly, live music, food, wine, and beer. Team registration at the Normandy Village Facebook page. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Even in today's era, it's a hard thing to come out to family as lesbian or gay or transgender or questioning. A story about just how hard in just a few minutes on 89.1 and WGLT.org. The electric vehicle revolution that Rivian wants to ride depends on who has the power, literally the electricity. The country's uneven charging infrastructure will continue to be built out in years ahead. We've already seen dozens of charging stations in Bloomington Normal, courtesy of the now defunct EV Town initiative. As Rivian gets ready for production in Normal next year, WGLT's Ryan Denham was curious about what comes first, EV adoption or the charging infrastructure. He spoke to somebody with the answer, Dan Bauermaster, the program manager for electric transportation at the Electric Power Research Institute in the heart of Silicon Valley, California. They start by talking about Rivian.
Taking a step back and looking at the numbers, the top three best-selling cars in the U.S. year after year, in fact, it goes back decades, have been the big trucks from the big three, the Ford F-Series and the Chevy Silverado and its GMC twin and the Dodge Ram or the Ram truck now. So you could say their market is a smart one to go into if you're looking at the numbers. The product has impressive specs with the range and the performance, so that's it. Could be exciting to see how that pans out in the real world.
What is unique about what Rivian is doing with its battery packs and the skateboard that it's created?
They're definitely taking advantage of one of the advantages of doing a ground-up electric vehicle. What I mean by that is an electric vehicle doesn't have a traditional gas motor or often even drive shaft, so what it does, it frees up a lot of room in the traditional chassis to kind of reorientate where the rest of the parts go in an electric vehicle. That's primarily the battery and, the battery control system, et cetera. So what that does is, and we've seen this with other manufacturers, it really frees up design and engineering. So what that means is, a lower center of gravity kind of spreads out the mass, and, as you mentioned, referred to in the industry is kind of like a skateboard chassis. So not only does that help improve the specs of the vehicle, but also you basically have the guts, the skateboard, and then it also gives the manufacturer flexibility on what the body is that goes on top. And, we've seen this with other manufacturers too. Rivian hasn't said what else they're doing, but they have talked about they have five or six other vehicles that they are considering that could be built off the same chassis. So more to come there, definitely.
Well, one of Rivian's main selling points has been the long range of their first pickup and SUV. Around 400 miles on a single charge, potentially. And I'm curious as to how long that will be sort of a selling point. Will that sort of range or even beyond that become, sort of the norm in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, what you can see happening, I mean, there's kind of a joke in the industry is, you ask someone today what their ideal range is, whether it's gas or electric, and they give you a number, and then that becomes the new norm. Then you ask people again what they like, and it's, the old number plus, call it 20% or 30%. So, I mean, the point is we humans always want more. That's a good thing. Keeps everything innovative. But I guess the point is that Rivian is doing what some other electric vehicle companies are doing as well, or what other car companies are doing with their EVs, and that's offering various size batteries. So, Nissan is doing that with the Leaf. Tesla does it. There's a few other companies that are said they're going to offer, multi value packs. And in my opinion, it's a smart business decision that these car companies are doing, because it lets the customer kind of pick and pay for the battery size that they want or need. And that's, at the end of the day, it's all about flexibility. With the kind of the market segment of pickup trucks and SUVs, you have other, call it use cases, or just call it uses by the customer, whether it's, towing a boat or going to, a national park, maybe a bit further off the normal path of a day-to-day commute. So, having a longer battery option in that kind of price class, to me anyway, makes extra sense.
Electric vehicles like the ones that Rivian is going to be making are going to obviously rely on the electric charging infrastructure that exists all over the country. I mean, you could charge in your own home, but there are going to be times when you have to kind of charge on the go. How would you characterize kind of the state of the current EV charging infrastructure in this country as of today?
You can actually charge your electric car, even the big ones, off a normal 120 volt, a new, grounded and safe wall outlet. In fact, that's what my family and I did with our first two EVs. That's all AC charging, and that's what most people will do on a daily basis, especially if you have access to covered overnight parking, not even covered, but your own overnight parking. Then there's the question of what about the road trips? And that's where you get into more of the kind of what we think of today is like the gas station type experience. that's what's known as fast charging, and Rivian, like a lot of the other fully electric vehicles, can do that as well. And that's intended right now to be more of a, like, when you stop for, you know, stop for a cup of coffee, or you stop for lunch, so if you're stopping for 15 or 20 minutes, you basically get a fast charge in that time that you, you know, stop for a snack, you stop for a quick meal, you know, your car basically will charge up, you know, 60 to 80%. That's the vision of fast charging. And as far as the actual state of that fast charging, there's various groups or various kind of tranches across the U.S. that are doing this. First of all, the utilities have $3.7 billion, that's billion with a B, charging infrastructure, not just fast charging, but all types of charging, either proposed or approved in front of the regulators across the country. Of that $3.7 billion, some of that involves the utilities actually owning and maintaining the charging station, and some of it is a utility will basically pay for everything up to the charging station, and they'll give a rebate to the whoever owns the site, say the shopping mall or a coffee shop or something like that. The next tranche of charging infrastructure is largely a result of the Volkswagen diesel settlement. That's about $2 billion. Volkswagen is setting up a subsidiary called Electrify America. They're putting in about $2 billion of fast chargers across the country, and those will be accessible to everybody, not just Volkswagen. The third tranche is Tesla. Tesla is famous for their supercharging process. They have about 13,000 charging stations and 4,000 locations across North America, but Tesla uses a different plug than the rest of the industry. And then the fourth and last tranche of charging infrastructure is what's been done for, say, the last like 7 or 8 years, largely with a combination of taxpayer money and private money. Those are smaller networks for not just fast chargers, but quite a few fast chargers.
Well, what about kind of visibility of the public side of EV charging infrastructure? I mean, one of the reasons that people feel confident driving a car is because they can, you know, you can like see a gas station every mile or two. I wonder if EV charging stations need to be more visible so that people, you know, who are thinking about buying one, you know, see them all over the place, and it gives them kind of that peace of mind that may help adoption. What do you make of that?
You know, EPRI's been doing research on electric vehicles for almost 3 decades now. And to that exact point, we did a study in Japan more than 10 years ago when EVs were first coming out. About, it was basically, they launched, Mitsubishi launched an electric car, and there was not fast charging stations. And we did a study of people driving along with the local utilities there. And then the Japanese utility put in a bunch of fast charging stations, and they did studies again of where people charged and all that. And lo and behold, it's exactly what you said. Everyone loves having the idea of these public fast charging stations, but no one used them. So it kind of became a joke. It's like, well, maybe some of these fast charging stations just need to be paper mache, just for that. I mean, again, that's not obviously what we're going to do, but the point is that we all like, and there needs to be some kind of safety net. Let's not be, you know, I don't want to be too flippant here. There needs to be a safety net for public charging. But at the end of the day, you know, most people are going to charge at home or work. But what, you know, one of the advantages of the EV, it's just like your smartphone. You wake up every day and it's fully charged and ready to go. So it's, or you step out of your office and it's fully charged and ready to go. So it's different. And that change part is hard. But once people shift to an EV or a plug-in hybrid, then it's one of the things that they actually love.
You know, I've often heard that this whole thing kind of framed as a chicken or the egg. You know, what comes first? Is it going to be electric vehicle adoption and then we build the charging infrastructure to meet it? Or do you build out charging infrastructure and that aids adoption? What do you make of that dichotomy? Is it, given home charging, can we just have adoption happen and have that go ahead of charging infrastructure?
Yeah, so I think you need both. Like I said, you know, you need a safety net. You need to be enable the folks that can't charge necessarily at home if you live in an apartment or if your workplace hasn't put in charging yet. But I do, you know, especially in the last 6 to 12 months, like, you know, as this charging infrastructure is going in. And now, granted, there's U.S. auto market when it comes to EVs is kind of split into two realities. One reality is there's about a dozen states that follow the California zero emission vehicle standards. And in those states, there's about 40 EVs that customers can pick from. And then in the ones that don't follow California, the supply, the customer choice is much more limited. You know, it's down, I mean, I have to double check the numbers, but it's about a dozen or so. You know, when you think about scale and you think about cost, a lot of great work has been done by the automakers on making electric vehicles, but most of them have been in like just regular hatchbacks and sedans, which is a declining part of the market. So, you know, that's don't have plug-in EVs in the body, for the most part, in the body styles that American consumers want. The good news is that if you look out to 2023, there's going to be about 120 different EVs to pick from based off the automaker's announcement. And to me, what's more important than that, number, I mean, that's a big number. The part to me that's more important is like more than a third of those will be, you know, SUVs and quote-unquote crossovers, and even a couple pickup trucks, one of which being Rivian. You know, today, yes, there's not as much product choice to pick from for EVs, but if you look ahead, you know, a good 3 years or so, there's going to be a lot more.
So electric vehicles are obviously perceived to be more environmentally friendly, but, you know, the past couple of years, I've seen obviously plenty of articles about a sort of hidden environmental impact. After all, the electricity has to come from somewhere, so unless that's nuclear or wind or solar, you know, you could be looking at a carbon impact somewhere in that production of the electricity, even if the car itself doesn't emit carbon. So, I don't know, what does the science really bear out within that issue?
It's important to say, like, yes, you have to generate electricity from somewhere, and yes, you have to, you know, a vehicle, whether it's gas, diesel, or, you know, kind of, you know, electric powered, you know, you have to mine that raw material from somewhere. So everything has consequence, and that's important to say. EPRI, together with other partners, has done extensive research on this. There's kind of two categories of pollution, at least the way I see it. There's the greenhouse gas, you know, which is the whole climate change, and EVs, hands down, are better. In fact, like, kind of the rough bogey is, even if you have a grid powered by 100% coal, which, mind you, that is, I think, basically nowhere in the U.S. right now, even if the grid is 100% coal, that's equivalent to the greenhouse gas of a 36-mile-per-gallon car. And, you know, I'm sure, as we were talking earlier, like, 36 miles per gallon is great, and most, you know, Tahoes and 4Runners and Escalades and Explorers don't get 36 miles per gallon. So that's, like, worst-case scenario. So that's, like, one part. So as far as the carbon, electric vehicles are better enough. And then the next part, which doesn't get as much attention, is the air quality. So it's basically all the little fine particles that come out of our exhaust pipes. You know, that impacts human health, whether it's, you know, oxides of nitrogen, or, you know, you can go through the whole list. But it's basically all the dirt and grit that comes out your tailpipe. Now, yes, when you generate electricity, there's also similar emissions, but a couple things. That's smaller amount, easier to regulate, because, you know, fewer power plant smokestacks versus exhaust pipes. And also, it's further away from human. I mean, there's so many studies out there that have shown this. Basically, like, the closer you are as a human to an exhaust pipe, like if you're walking on a sidewalk in a busy street, that's obviously way worse for your health as far as that air quality versus like a power plant that's hundreds of some miles away. Yeah, that power plant is still impacting air quality, but A, it's less, and B, it's not a direct impact on human health.
That's Dan Bauermaster, the Program Manager for Electric Transportation at the Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto, California, speaking with WGLT's Ryan Denham. You can follow all of WGLT's coverage of Rivian at our website, wglt.org/Rivian. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. ISU students are back in town. Classes have begun. Most people are chipper, upbeat, looking forward to the school year, except for a few for whom the start of college has become a much grimmer affair. ISU already has had 3 requests for emergency assistance from a fund dedicated to helping LGBTQ students. David Bentlin is with the Prairie Pride Coalition and helps administer the fund under the Dean of Students' Office. He joins us to talk about the stories of economic and spiritual distress from those students at the hands of their own families.
In each of the cases, they came out to their families, and families reacted negatively, withdrew financial support, withdrew emotional support, and in one case, there was some physical violence involved.
You would think that in this day and age, this would be rare. Not so?
I agree. I would think that after all of that we've accomplished as an LGBTQ community, the laws that have been passed, the greater freedoms that many of us feel, the greater rights that many of us enjoy, there is a thought that these are unusual situations to find happening today. I do think, though, that it continues. What's happening in one sense is that these students are feeling braver about coming out, and they're coming out at younger ages. I'm with the Prairie Pride Coalition, and just yesterday we were at Bloomington Junior High School for a table fair to welcome the sixth graders to the junior high, and some of them are coming out, and we wanted to be there to provide resources not only for them, but for their parents, so that we can get information to them and we can address the issues that they're feeling and maybe prevent some of what's happening at the college level with these students who are experiencing bad things with their families.
And in those settings where you're trying to educate, are you still getting pushback from certain segments of parents?
From certain segments, yes.
Especially, what do they
say? Well, especially when we're getting into areas like junior high schools, and some of the younger populations. But what we try to explain to the parents is that these children are coming out at an earlier and earlier age. They're finding communities on social media. They're finding information on websites. They're seeing themselves portrayed on television, and they want to be open, and they want to be out, and they want to feel safe and welcome in their community. So they're coming out at earlier and earlier ages. And we try to impress upon the parents and the families that it's important that these issues get addressed when these students and children are coming out at an earlier age, so that they can feel comfortable, they can feel safe, they can feel included, and they can feel some sense of support from their families.
In one of the incoming or returning ISU students' cases, there was actually some physical abuse. What happened in that case?
Well, the nature of the fund that we use to support these students, we maintain complete confidentiality. So I'm not really, I don't feel comfortable going into very real specifics about it. But I can say that I think there was violence sustained that would result in a trip to a hospital. It was pretty severe, and it was unfortunate.
It's natural for a kid to go to a parent, to a family, and say, accept me, this is what I am, this is what I'm about. But do they not know that this outcome is possible when they've been in this family setting for a while and presumably know the parental attitudes or the attitudes of the family?
I think it is possible. I think that some of them go into this with a realistic expectation that it could turn out one way or could turn out another. I was looking through some of the applications that we received for the Student Support Fund, and there are a variety of instances where good things happen and not so good things happen. One parent reacts positively, another reacts very negatively, and sometimes it is a surprise. Sometimes they're surprised by which parent is more supportive than the other. So there are other times when neither parent is supportive. There are other times when certain family members are supportive, but they won't step up to defend the family member who just came out. So we're running into a variety of situations where they're feeling different levels of acceptance or non-acceptance.
Other people who have been on our air in recent months talking about LGBTQI+ issues have said, you know, you have to be prepared for whatever comes if you're going to do this, if you're going to come out. Are these students prepared? Are they accepting that this stuff happens? It could happen.
Some of them are, and some of them probably are not. It's been a few years since I've been in that situation of being a teenager, coming out to family, and it's a terrifying time, and as much as you try to plan it and you try to think about all the possibilities and you try to make arrangements for whatever reaction you might get, I still think there are some cases where the students have not thought about everything and they've not thought about that worst-case scenario, and maybe a little bit of naivete that goes into it, but at any rate, regardless of that, the treatment that these students have received is not warranted.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with David Bentlin about the assistance fund that ISU has for LGBTQI+ people who have been rejected by their families or cut off from support. How much call has this fund had this year?
It's been busy this year. I'll say that since January we have had 9 students that we have supported. All who have come out to family members and have lost the emotional and financial support, either partial or complete financial support of those family members. And so luckily we've had this fund set up since 2005, and we've helped a number of students over, 14 years now.
How does the number 9 is in this calendar year compare to other years?
I would say this has probably been one of the biggest years we've had in terms of the number of students that we've served. Last year was busy. Actually, since starting in 2017, we've seen an uptick in the number of students who've come to us seeking help.
And why, do you think?
I think there's a climate in our society where folks feel emboldened. On one hand, folks feel emboldened to come out and be who they want to be, which is a good thing. I encourage that adds to the well-being of the individual. At the same time, I think that other parts of our society have been emboldened to come out and be upfront in their hate and their displeasure and their opposition to members of the LGBTQI+ community.
I'm having a little struggle thinking that a rejection of a family member would come in part from an external climate. It would seem to me that a family dynamic is more likely to play out with internal predispositions and forces. But you're saying that's not exactly it.
I think there are influences. I don't believe it's any one aspect of the situation that causes a parent or a family member to react the way they do. In thinking back on the applications that we've received, students have mentioned spirituality and religious issues that have come into play. Parents that tell them that it's in opposition to their spiritual beliefs. So I do think that there are some outside influences that really create an environment that makes it challenging for students today to be out and to be themselves and to depend on the support of their families.
What do these kids need who are applying to the fund?
They need help to get through the remaining years of their college education here at Illinois State University in a general sense. The fund has been used these past years to cover costs of books, to help cover tuition costs, to help cover apartment and housing fees, to pay for meal plans at the campus dining centers. So whatever funds are used from that source are used for the students to help them complete their education at Illinois State University. In a larger sense, I hope that this fund for these students is like a warm blanket around them, so that they can feel that despite the ostracization that they've felt from their families, that there is a community here that supports them, that this is a campus that is here for them, that wants to see them excel and be their best possible person, both in the classroom and on campus. So I hope that this fund goes a long way toward making them feel that sense of community and support.
For those who might be inclined to contribute to the fund, can you unpack how decisions are made about who gets what money and who the decision makers are?
Sure. The fund is housed in the Dean of Students office. Jill Benson, who's Associate Dean of Students in that office, is the fiscal agent for the fund. There is a screening committee, consists of myself and Barb Dallinger. We look at the applications as they come in, and we make a decision as to how much we can support the application, and then Jill meets with the students and gets a better idea of specifically what they need short term, long term, and then we proceed and we help support them with the fund.
How much money in support is happening per student? Really, you mentioned tuition. That's going to be a fairly big chunk, but
right. In looking at the applications that we received this year, we're averaging between $1,500 and $2,000 a student. In some ways, it's a drop in the bucket, but at the same time, it does help these students, and these students are very resourceful. They're applying for scholarships. They're working 2 and 3 jobs. So they're active participants in trying to find solutions to their situations as well. So we're one part of the solution, and we're happy to be here to provide that part of the solution.
Are these experiences convincing some students, some young people, to stay in the closet?
I think there are some students who might think twice, who might hear about these situations where their fellow students are running into opposition, where they're running into non-support from family and even from friends. And it may have the result of making them think twice and making them feel that it's not quite as safe as they thought it was to be out and to be open and to be themselves. And I think when you get to that point, it's unfortunate because they're having to suppress a part of themselves. And when students come to Illinois State University, when they come to college, it's an opportunity for them to really discover themselves. And we don't want them to not have that experience. And so I hope that they'll weigh carefully the benefits and disadvantages of coming out, but that they'll know that regardless of what they do, that there is a community on campus and there are resources on campus to help them down whatever path they choose.
David Bentlin is with the Prairie Pride Coalition and Illinois State University. He helps administer the LGBTQ support fund at ISU. You can donate online at the ISU Foundation. Drill down a couple of links to the LGBTQ support fund. Questions to Jill Benson at the Dean of Students Office as well. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.